All right, to introduce our next and final candidate for the day is someone who needs very little introduction to this group or any other conservative group in America. He is one of the funding fathers of the conservative movement, Mr. Richard Vigor. He is a co-founder and senior executive committee member of the Council for National Policy. He is the chairman of the American Target Advertising Incorporated and conservativeheadquarters.com. He is the author of Takeover, the 100-Year War for the Soul of the GOP and How Conservatives Can Finally Win in 2014. He, along with several other books. He is the recipient of CMP Action Inc.'s Lantern of Liberty Award. He is married to Elaine, and they live in Virginia here. And let me just say this, I have great appreciation for Richard Vigory and what he has done for the conservative movement and how he has come along conservatives for many decades. And I'm grateful for his friendship, for his leadership, and let's please welcome and express our gratitude to Richard Vigory.
All right, everybody. Great to be with you this afternoon, and I'm especially pleased and honored to introduce my friend, Governor Jim Gilmore, to y'all. But for the longtime members of CNP, Jim needs no introduction. But for the newer members and guests, I want you to know that Governor Gilmore represents the three legs of Ronald Reagan's coalition. Governor Gilmore is an economic conservative, a cultural conservative, a national security conservative. If you read Jim's bio, as I have, it seems like he spent his entire adult life preparing to be president. He has a long and distinguished public service career, which started as a youngster in the College Young Republicans in Virginia, of course. He was a alternate delegate, in 1976 to the convention in Kansas City where I was supporting Ronald Reagan. Then after his college young Republican career, we got an undergraduate degree. He went on to get a law degree. Then he joined the Army and was trained in military intelligence. He served as a counterintelligence agent for the Army. After he got out, in 1987, he became Enrico County Commonwealth Attorney, which is part of the Richmond area. 1993, he was elected Attorney General. 1997, Governor of Virginia. In 2001, President Bush selected him to head up the Republican National Committee. And in addition to those activities for 10 years, 1993 to 2003, he chaired the Congressional Advisory Panel to assess domestic capabilities for terrorism involving weapons of mass destruction. Then he served as chairman of the National Council on Readiness and Preparedness, another homeland security program. He's also president of USA Secure, a homeland security think tank. So he's got enormous credentials in the overseas foreign policy arena to protects us locally, domestically, by serving on the board of directors of the National Rifle Association. He's a political commentator on Fox, and which should endear him deeply to all CNP members, he serves as president and CEO of our beloved Paul Weyrich's Free Congress Foundation. There's an old adage which I believe strongly in. Tell me who you walk with, and I'll tell you who you are. Jim walks with us and has for the many, many years that I've known him. He was elected governor, as I said, on several main points, issues. And one of them was he pledged to abolish the hated car tax. When he was elected governor, he set about to fulfill his promise. But the Republican Senate opposed his abolishing of the car tax. They fought it, he prevailed eventually. But he had to fight, as governor, Rhino Republicans to achieve his legislative objectives. Sound familiar, everybody? Let's welcome one of our own, Governor Jim Gilmore.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, thank you very much. I've got a lot of friends in the room, but I guess I probably ought to. I've been a member of this organization for many years and a part of the conservative movement my entire life. As Richard said when we started, you know, I've been a conservative my whole life. I got into youth politics when I first graduated from high school and started at college. And I was a alternate delegate in 1976. Most of you are probably not old enough to know that about that, but that was the year that Ronald Reagan took on Gerald Ford, and I was proud to be an alternate delegate that year as a very young man from Virginia for Ronald Reagan. So my reputation, I think, in conservative affairs still stands to this day. And of course, I've been working with Free Congress Foundation. Well, let me, you know, I like you, I sat and watched the show a little while ago and saw it, and it was quite entertaining, I must say. This talk today is going to be a little more about policy, a little different. But I will say that it was fun to turn on Saturday Night Live a couple of weekends ago and see that I was on there, and they were making fun of me. Miley Cyrus played my wife Roxanne, and I think she had Roxanne right down to a T, except that Roxanne doesn't have as many tattoos as Miley Cyrus has, but that's okay. You'll take your press any way you can get it. Folks, I'm going to talk to you about some things today. I'm not going to just simply talk. I'm going to talk to you about some things, and we're going to have some questions and answers here in a few minutes. I'm going to talk to you about what our candidate for president has got to address in order to win the 2016 election this coming year. And I want to say to you that the real problem that we need to address is the problem of the United States economy. The president of the United States says that everything is just fine out there, that everything is great, the unemployment number is down, and everything is great, and the American people don't have to worry about that anymore. They can go worry about something else. And I'm here to tell you that is not true. It is not true that things are all right. We're out there all day campaigning. I'm in New Hampshire. I'm in South Carolina. I've been out there talking to people. And I want you to know that people out there are concerned and frightened. We have never come out of the Great Recession. Never. Since this time is going on right now, we have not come out of the Great Recession. Last month, they reported anemic job creation in this country. I thought we were supposed to be coming out of the recession. Everything was supposed to be going great. The month before that, they had given great numbers, and they were now revised down very, very quietly so people wouldn't notice. People are concerned out there. We have 9 million people in this country that are working part-time that want to work full-time. We have chronically unemployed people. You know people that are out in the community. Young people who graduate from college, 47% graduate from college, and they don't even get an opportunity to have a job that's appropriate for their college degree. That means they're starting at $30,000 when they're supposed to be starting at $60,000. They may never catch up. We today, conservatives, owe it to the people of the United States to call out the truth and to say that the economy is not good. And we will not stand for a lost generation in this country of people who don't have an opportunity to grow and to have a chance to start a career and to advance. And this is the strength of the United States. And we're letting it go. We know that people are working part-time that want to work full-time. We know that there are plenty of workers out there, 50 and over, that are really frightened. They see their manufacturing jobs going away, and they say, gee, I'm going to lose my job. Then what am I going to do? Because we don't have a robust economy. And as a result of that, you don't have enough jobs to really compete for the people that are out there trying to get jobs. And that means that wages are flat. Now, it's true, isn't it? Everybody in the United States, whether you're a liberal or a conservative or a Republican or a Democrat, no matter who you are, everybody agrees that wages are stagnant in this country. And the Democrats want to take that on and make it their issue for 2016. How dare they? We Republicans have to grasp the future and talk about the economy and talk about the growth of the economy and wages. Now, sometimes we Republicans tend to say things that are pretty negative towards people out there. Make sure they don't vote for us. Make absolutely sure. I will tell you one thing that we need to say right now. I was going over to the Giant Food one day last year and got in the line. And, you know, I always pick the wrong line. I don't know about you, but I always do. And so I'm waiting to get up to the cash register, and nobody was moving. And I kind of peeked around to see what was going on. Young African-American woman, about 23 years old. She had a few items on the counter and a cabbage, and she was trying to pay for it with a plastic card. Well, you know what that was. That was a food stamp card that they've given people now. And finally, after many attempts, the cash register guy said, "Look, madam, you don't have enough money on that card to pay for these things." So she was embarrassed. So she said, "Just keep the four or five items that are here." She peeled off two $1 bills out of her pockets, probably all she had, and paid for the cabbage. And I thought to myself, is that all we've got to offer people in the United States of America today? We need to have a better economy and a better opportunity so even that young lady has got some options, some got some chances in life. And we need to speak for this. We conservatives need to speak for this. We should not be the movement of no. We should be the movement of the future for this country. But meanwhile, we want to let the Democrats capture this. Did you see the debate last week with Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton and the other yahoos that were up? Did you see that? I woke up when Bernie Sanders said that the problem was the middle class was dying. Their policies are what's hurting the middle class. Their socialism is what's hurting the middle class. How dare they do that? Now, I'm going to give you some actual substance here in this talk, okay? There are several things that they're doing out there that hurt this country, and we need to talk to the American people about it. They have instituted tax after tax after tax on business and commercial activity in this country. They have made it harder to start a business. They have made it harder to write off investments, making sure that there would be no investments. They've made it increased taxes on people who are making money from investments, making sure there are fewer investments. Investment is what creates opportunity in this country. It's what creates productivity. The Democrats have deliberately, absolutely deliberately passed laws they know will create slow growth in this country. They know they're doing it. And then they stand up on that stage and pretend that somehow they're for working men and women in this country. They're not. We are. We Republicans and conservatives stand for the working people of this country. Do you think it was deliberate when they passed Obamacare? They knew exactly what they were doing. They know they put in a provision that exempted people that didn't have a company that any bigger than 49 people, thus making absolutely sure that companies would be discouraged from growing above 49 people. They know exactly what they're doing. It's deliberate and it's certain. How about the Cadillac tax? If a company wants to actually recruit in good people and then pay for their health care and give them an opportunity to have a benefit, they may have to pay a penalty. Company's not going to do that. That increases the costs of doing business. They know that. The enemy knows that. And then regulations. Ladies and gentlemen, we ought not to be having this kind of regulatory society that we're living in. This is hurting us. Okay, so what specifically? Well, how about the Environmental Protection Agency now that takes every mud puddle and says that it's navigable waters and then fines you if you have a rainwater someplace on your lot? How about Sarbanes-Oxley that's now added ton after ton of money into the commercial activity just to reduce the opportunity to grow and to create something in this country? How about Dodd-Frank on small banks to make sure that people can't go out and get mortgages for new houses? These are the kind of regulations that must be evaluated. You can deal with these kinds of systemic issues, but you don't have to have this kind of regulatory policy, and they're doing it deliberately. They know they're creating slow growth. That's why they did it. And so what do they do now? Well, they got to boost up their benefit programs, because otherwise there's going to be social displacement in this country and maybe even revolution. So they increase Medicaid. Some of our Republican candidates running for president, John Kasich, for example, gave in and increased Medicaid in this country, in the state of Ohio. This, we Republicans and conservatives have got to stand against this and fight against this and talk about it as loud as possible every day. But a lot of the Republicans voted for those same tax increases. and they're not fighting hard enough against Obamacare, and they're no longer speaking out against the regulations. We need a Republican leader who will stand up and speak out and say that we are the voice of working men and women in this country. And I will be that candidate. Listen, I've got a tax program that's been out there. We developed it at the Free Congress Foundation. I put it on the web page in 2010. It stands the test of time, and now I've adopted it, and I'm going to run on it. And what I'm saying is you reform the personal tax code 10, 15, and 25% and make it very clear that you're going to give a tax cut to working men and women in this country. You want a candidate who's actually done that? Well, I've done that. As governor of Virginia, as Richard said in the introduction, I proposed a car tax cut in my state. I was swept in by the people of Virginia, and I kept my word, and I actually did it. And I cut taxes in Virginia against the opposition of the Republican rhinos in the Virginia State Senate. I had to fight them every day in order to accomplish everything that I was able to do. Secondly, we need to take all commercial activity, combine it together, and charge a rate of 15%. You can do that. You can buy down the deductions and the credits and all those kinds of things that we don't have to do anymore. And you can, in fact, charge a 15% rate, which will suddenly make us competitive with the rest of the world. Why they complain, are we taking our businesses and our employees overseas and hiring people overseas? Because we have a policy in this country that deliberately intends that. Buy the rate down to 15%, make us competitive. And finally, once and for all, kill off the death tax in this country, once and for all. Oh, sure. They'll tell you it doesn't mean that much money. They'll tell you that. But here's the truth. The truth is that we need to start sending a message again out of the White House that we actually care about the free market system in this country. We actually stand for opportunity and entrepreneurship and wealth creation and a chance for people in this country to grow and to create something. The death tax sends a message that we're not for that. You can work all your life, pay taxes on everything, build something significant. You've already paid taxes to create it in the first place, and now we're going to double tax it again? What's fair about that? The message that we send today is one of unfairness. It's time for we conservatives to stand for fairness on behalf of real people who have created something in the United States of America, and I'm going to be that candidate. Richard gave you a sense of what my background has been. There's a lot of talk right now about outsiders versus insiders. Well, you've heard from some people who claim that they're outsiders. There ain't anybody on these debate stages who's an outsider, ladies and gentlemen. I can tell you that right now. They're insiders. They're insiders. Well, I may be an outsider, but I'm not an amateur. So the question, I guess, for us conservatives, though, is, are we going to offer an amateur to be president of the United States? Big bet, isn't it? Big bet. So the people of the United States say, well, you know, maybe we don't want an amateur at this particular point in time. Seems to me we just had an amateur as president of the United States. So maybe we better get somebody that knows what they're doing in this time of crisis. Well, my degree is in Soviet affairs. I'm a United States Army veteran. I served in the Cold War. I was an intelligence agent stationed in Europe during the Cold War for NATO. I was an elected prosecutor in my home state of Virginia. I was the Attorney General of Virginia, the Governor of Virginia. I was the chairman of the National Commission on Terrorism and Homeland Security for the United States of America, appointed by the United States Congress to address that issue. I counseled Bill Clinton and George W. Bush on this issue before the 9/11 attack happened, and I was the governor during the 9/11 attack. And I had to, at that point, as the chief executive of my state, deal with a state that was directly under attack because the second state attacked that day was Virginia. Many of you may have known Barbara Olson. Some of you are here that may have remembered Barbara Olson. She was a movement conservative. She was on the plane that flew into the Pentagon that day. And she was a good supporter and a friend of mine. I chaired the National Commission on the Internet and Sales Tax Issues in this country, a commission that was set up for the purpose of getting the maximum possible taxes on the Internet. Funny thing happened on the way to the pro-tax commission for the Internet. I became the chairman. Grover Norquist and I teamed up. He was on the commission, and we issued a report that said there should not be taxes on the Internet. I was the chairman of the United States Air Force Academy. I'm on the board of directors of the National Rifle Association right now, and stand up for the Second Amendment. And I've had good success in business as well. So the question really is going to be this. The American people at some point are going to wake up and they're going to say, wait a minute, this is all fun and games, but the fact is, who can actually be the president of the United States? We've already had somebody that can't be president of the United States, particularly in this time of foreign policy crisis, ladies and gentlemen. Look at this right now, foreign policy crisis. You think this is the time for an amateur? Look at what we've just gotten with this Iran deal. Not only is it a bad deal, but they turned the Constitution on its head, didn't they? And said that if the deal was going to be blocked, the Republicans had to get a majority to block it. Oh, no, no, not a majority. They had to get 60% to stop the filibuster. Oh, no, not that. If they're going to block it, they got to overcome the veto of the president by 2/3. Now, who voted to turn the Constitution and treaty provisions on its head? Democrats and Republicans. As a matter of fact, all four of the senators running for president of the United States, Cruz, Rubio, Graham, and Paul, all voted for the Corker Amendment to turn the Constitution on its head. So people will talk to you a good game, but the fact of the matter is you have to have somebody with real presidential strength, somebody that will stand up to the challenges that we face from Russia, from China, from Iran, and from this dissolution of the Middle East leading to an international guerrilla war that we're in right now. And I say this, you have to have real presidential leadership. I got to take a couple extra minutes, I can tell you this. I'm not quite there yet. Do you remember what kind of leadership we've gotten from President Obama? He goes to Cairo and apologizes for the United States, setting the tone for his administration. He goes to West Point and tells those bright young people that are getting ready to take their commissions, don't worry, you're not going to be in any conflict anymore. He goes to the National Prayer Breakfast and says, well, we know ISIS is bad, but the Christians were just as bad during the Crusade. And at that time, in an exercise of almost presidential leadership, I stood up and said that was the worst thing I'd ever heard a president of the United States say in my lifetime. Strong political leadership is going to do what people across the world who are our adversaries will recognize and respect. Secondly, you've got to put some weight behind it. The sequester has to come off the defense budget. And if Harry Reid says, well, we want equal benefit spending and welfare state spending if for every dollar you spend on defense, a president has to go to the American people and say, these people in Congress are threatening the safety and security of this country. That's presidential leadership. And get the sequester off the defense budget and build up and rebuild our Navy. You know, we don't even have an aircraft carrier in the Middle East right now because our ships can't stay on station because there are too few surface vessels. Our Marines are lacking a combat brigade. Our United States Army has gone down as a result of the Middle East. We have to rebuild and show that we're actually strong. And I, alone in this race, have proposed that we rebuild a NATO in the Middle East to stand up to the expansion of Iran, and now, I'm sorry to say, the expansion of the Russian influence. We can do that. We can build that kind of organization with American affirmative leadership, and that's what a president must do. I'm a member of this organization. There are a lot of different kinds of conservatives in this room. I know almost everybody here. And everybody's different. But I will say several things to you. I am right to life. I stood up for the right to life as governor. As governor, we sponsored and passed a ban on partial birth abortion. As governor, We passed a parental notification and consent bill. There was a right to death case. Everybody remember the Schiavo case? We had that case in Virginia. It was called the Hugh Finn case. And the wife wanted to pull the plug on Hugh Finn. And the family members came to me and said, "You're not getting the facts. Hugh Finn is not comatose." And at that point I said, "I'm going to intervene in order to find out the truth here and not allow someone to just pull the plug on someone." Same case. And I have the scars to pay for that to this very day, that the press ripped into me as a result of trying to stand up for life. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's the points that I really want to make. I'm going to say one word about Trumpism. I have given you here today some things that you may or may not have gotten in the other candidates. I've tried to tell you actually who I am, what I think the problems are, and what we must do. And I'm offering you an opportunity to have a candidate who not only has been elected, but is actually electable, actually can win the race on behalf of you as a conservative. That is the kind of candidate that I am and will be. I tell you now, ladies and gentlemen, you may or may not agree, I'm not in favor of open borders. I believe we have to secure our borders. I'm not in favor of illegal immigrants who are violent criminals. I think we should get them off the street, and I have the experience to do it as a former prosecutor on the ground and as a former attorney general. I believe we have to do those things. But I will not attack the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. I will not be that kind of conservative that attacks the Second Amendment when it's convenient, attacks the 14th Amendment when it's convenient. I will not do that, and I will not do this. I will not send a message on behalf of our conservative movement of hatred and resentment to other people in this country. I will not do it. There, of course, is a practical reason. People have told me the facts and the truth. If you don't increase your Latino vote, you can't win in 2016. None of our candidates can win. That is a fact. And Trumpism is about making sure we don't get any Latino vote. Any. And that's where we stand today, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm saying to you, I believe that we as a movement have an obligation to reject this message of ethnic setting people aside and being resentful and hateful. If that becomes our message, we will not win, and Hillary Clinton or somebody like, or even Bernie Sanders for that matter, will be president of the United States. I'm not willing to put up with that, and that's not the kind of candidate I want to be. I want to be a candidate who can win, and I want to be a candidate who has a lifelong history of standing for the principles that you and I believe in. Thank you very much for the chance to be with you. I look forward to the Q&A. Thank you.
Thank you, Governor Gilmore.
Thank you
for being with us. And of course, I don't need to explain the Council for National Policy to you. You're a member. You know what we represent. And of course, the questions that our members have cover the landscape of the conservative movement. So we're going to begin with one of the questions regarding the rule of law, something you obviously know much about. And it comes from Trent England, who is a member of our executive committee.
Who I know.
Governor Gilmore, over here.
Trent.
Thank you for being here and for your membership in CNP. I think that many people in this room had a sense of lost opportunity and injustice when, at the beginning of the George W. Bush administration, the position was taken that we should simply move on and ignore what happened during the Clinton administration rather than investigating the corruption. Many of us look ahead in hopes of a Republican taking office in 2017 and wonder if that would be the direction that person would take. The question to you is, if you were to be the next president of the United States, would you commit to investigating fully things like Benghazi, things like the Hillary Clinton email scandals, and seeing that justice was done in your administration, even if it raises awkward questions about the last one?
Would you prefer an answer or just a lot of talk? An answer. Yes, I would conduct those investigations. Yes, I would. And I believe this. I think that we have a right there. You may notice what's been going on in the press with Hillary Clinton lately and how Bernie Sanders gave her a pass on the issue of her emails and so on. Well, they'll get no pass from me on these things. First of all, I think we have a right to know whether something else could have been done in Benghazi. We have a right to know the answer to that as American citizens. I myself want to know why we couldn't have known in advance what was going to happen. And once it became apparent what was going to happen, why didn't we get United States Navy jets over that space going at above 150 feet above the land and scaring the heck out of people so that they got bought some time for us to get our people in there to protect our diplomats? We are entitled to an answer. And if the answer exonerates Hillary Clinton and all those people around her, so be it. But hiding and ducking and weaving the way the Clintons always do, that's not appropriate. And it creates a sense that this candidate, Hillary Clinton, ought not to be president. In April this year, I went on a show and I said that because Hillary Clinton had conducted herself as Secretary of State and at the same time stayed connected with the Clinton Foundation, which was accepting millions and millions of dollars from overseas interests, and then deleted her emails, she has an obligation as the next president to restore the American people's faith in the ethics, honesty, and responsibility of the next president. She cannot do that, and therefore she is disqualified from this race. Disqualified. Now, and what else you got? What other investigations are there? I think that we're entitled, unlike Bernie Sanders, we're entitled to know the answers. Tired of her emails? No. We have a right to know what was in the emails. We have a right to know. By the way, Tony, just very quickly, I was an intelligence agent stationed in NATO during the European conflict with the Russians during the Cold War, and I handled classified information. And you treat that stuff like dynamite. You are really, really careful about that. And furthermore, our adversaries would just kill to be able to read her private personal emails. And she didn't secure those things. And our adversaries then know, even to this day, all about her and all about her connections and all about the country that she was connected with because of her inattention and irresponsibility. These things need to be investigated. They will be when I'm president.
Very good. Let's return to one of the social issues, and Donna Rice Hughes has that question.
Hi. Thank you, and thank you, Governor, for all your leadership in the state of Virginia. And my question is that in light of the peer-reviewed research and medical science that now confirms the social cost of extreme and often deviant internet pornography as a fueling factor in the sexual exploitation of children, violence against women, pornography addiction, the breakdown of marriage and divorce, sexual predation, and sex trafficking, and that's just for starters. if you're elected president, it's a multiple part question. What will you do about the Department of Justice's failure to enforce the existing federal obscenity laws and other laws designed to prevent the sexual exploitation of children under the Clinton and Obama administrations? And one other thing is, would you be willing as a candidate to sign a presidential pledge that if elected, you would enforce those laws? We'll be circulating that soon. And then next, given the moral depravity in America, how will you advance and restore a culture in which all people, both born and unborn, are treated with dignity and respect?
Well, thank you. And that's a great question. Listen, and I'll try to give you a straight answer. Sure, I would sign that. I think that there are plenty of laws on the books. I know when as a trained constitutional attorney, I recognize the challenges of addressing the First Amendment and standing up for the First Amendment and giving latitude for liberty in America. But the culture of morality has a place in the life of this country and in the law of this country as well. And I would certainly make sure that all of our laws are vigorously prosecuted and enforced. No issue about that anywhere. Now, the more interesting question is the second half of the question, which is the culture. A president can, in fact, establish a culture in this country and speak out on issues. I made that point, Tony, a few minutes ago from the lectern. There's an opportunity for a president to actually say what he thinks ought to be done. And as President of the United States, I say to you, I will speak out on these issues as president and try to establish a new culture in this country that restores the validity of parents to be able to set those standards for young people in their families. And to say what's right and wrong without fear that somehow they're going to be laughed down or intimidated down. I'll do that as President of the United States. And I must say to you that this president does do that. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily on that issue, but I am personally shocked that this president has decided just to simply release people from the penitentiary on drug matters. I can tell you now, I've been in these courtrooms, I've seen these cases. We don't typically send a lot of people to the penitentiary for using marijuana.
Right.
We just don't do that, really. Or even drugs, if they're just users, there's often diversion. We send people to penitentiary for doing commercial activities and dealing in narcotics repeatedly and over and over. I consider dealing drugs to be a violent crime, and the president is out of line to reduce, to let people go to the penitentiary, asserting that these are nonviolent criminals. If you sell drugs in this country, that is a violent crime. And so he's setting that tone. He's setting that standard. It's an example. And I will, of course, set quite a different tone when I am president.
Thank you, Governor. Let's turn now to the economy and economic issues. We heard Bernie Sanders talk a lot about this disparity in income, inequality. And to ask this question, we have Keith Lewis.
Governor, thank you for your commitment to CNP over the years and always showing up with us and being a part of the question, the answer, and all that you do for this organization. So as Tony said, if we look to the economic issues, with all the Democrat hubris about income equality and this income inequality, the question really is, the Obama administration has destroyed the middle class. This was not their message, but this is in effect what they've done. You explain why it is then that still we have 95% of the wealth created during this Obama administration has continued to then go to that 1%.
I think we need to look at the numbers and see whether those kinds of statistics are exaggerated. A great deal of wealth has been created across all lines, and I'm not really a person who believes in class warfare. I think that the Democrats are wrong to engage in class warfare. How dare they stand up in the Democratic debate? We now, by the way, I think are perfectly okay to say that the Democratic Party is the Socialist Party of this country. Yeah. Right? They're labeling themselves the Socialist Party in this country. So we got a perfect right to say that. But as I said in my opening remarks, they have passed these laws specifically to hurt the middle class. It is the middle class, people who are working for a living, who all of a sudden are going to have lost their ability to have their health care, no longer have the ability to get it as a benefit seriously from their businesses. That's been being removed step by step by step. And the most important point about the middle class is that wages are stagnant. Everybody knows it. Everybody is frustrated. Everybody is angry. We've always thought in America, it's part of the American ideal, that the next generation will do better than the last. That's always been part of the American culture. People don't believe that anymore. Donald Trump talks about polls and almost nothing but polls. Well, there was a poll that said that Americans no longer believe that their children will do as well as they. That, ladies and gentlemen, is anti-American. And it is our duty as conservatives to apply the principles of the free market system to make sure that opportunities do present themselves. I said in my opening remark, this is a signature issue for me. We're going to go to the American people with this very issue. Why is this going on? It's going on right now because we are discouraging entrepreneurship. We are taking away the capital from people that can get ahead. We are not creating the opportunity for people to work and to grow and to have increased wages. It makes it impossible for them to get loans and mortgages. It makes it impossible to get capital in order to try to do something exciting. The middle class is all about the opportunity to grow and save and have a better quality of life. And this economy is flat, and it is deliberately flat. It is deliberately flat. They're doing things right now they know are going to stop the growth in this economy. I propose that we Republicans go to the people and offer them a vision for the future that's actually forward-looking and optimistic and can actually create something. And that means, number one, you got to get rid of these bad laws that they've put into place. We have to take that action to get rid of this. And if the Republicans are putting these things into place, Tony, we've got to get rid of them too.
I'm all for that.
We got to do that. So this is the signature issue that we conservatives should be speaking out on.
Related to the economy, the greatest single predictor of child poverty is the configuration of the home in which they go home from the hospital, whether or not they have a mother and a father that are married in their home. We've seen the institution of marriage under attack by the court. And our next question is regarding that, and it comes from Preston Noel.
Hello, Preston.
Thank you, Governor. Thank you, Tony. Governor, I really always appreciate the way you answer questions. You're very straightforward, manly, military. I like that. Just first get that out of the way here. Sir, since the Obergefell decision, where five lawyers imposed same-sex, quote-unquote, marriage on the American people, we have seen good Christians such as Kim Davis be jailed, sent to jail by her government because she wouldn't do what a federal judge said she had to do. She's an elected official. Two questions. Do you accept the idea that this is now a settled issue? And second question, if you're elected president, what specifically will you do on day one to ensure that our religious rights, our rights of conscience, are respected in law?
Okay. Well, first of all, I believe that marriage ought to be between a man and a woman. That's what I've always believed. That's what I've always said. I continue to say that. We conservatives probably should have proposed some alternative form of union on day one, and we didn't. We decided to fight it out on the marriage issue. And now we've got a Supreme Court decision here that's going to be very, very difficult to change. But it is remarkable, isn't it, that a court decision like that could be made within America today. That means that the left has changed the culture of this country and the way of thinking about these issues. And traditional marriage has taken a back seat. I believe that a president is in a position to begin to offer the kind of cultural leadership that begins to once again restore thinking about marriage between men and women. Now, I don't particularly want to be abusive towards homosexuals and gay people. I don't particularly want to do that. But the institution of marriage is a religious and institution that has been passed down through the ages. And I believe that we can have a president that starts talking about that and tries to find some other way that gay people can connect with each other, but not in a way that is in traditional marriage. And what can we do? Well, first of all, we have to obey the law. There's no doubt about that. But the law follows the culture of the nation. And that is our job here at CNP, and that's our job as a conservative movement, to stand up for the issue and begin to talk about it and begin to change the culture of this country so that, in fact, an adjustment can be made in the law at the Supreme Court and, frankly, at the congressional level, if necessary, at the constitutional level.
Are you familiar? Let me follow up with that, because there's legislation at the federal level and the local level, the First Amendment Defense Act, which Mike Lee from Utah has introduced, that would provide protections for those based upon their view of marriage, so that the government cannot take punitive action just because someone believes marriage is a union of man and woman. Do you support legislation such as that?
Yes, I do, but I think in all fairness, if a person's going to take a public office and swear an oath to uphold the Constitution and the law, they have to uphold the Constitution and the law. But their liberty to feel the way that they do and to speak out the way they do and begin to address these issues in a public way. And I think that that's what she should be doing. I think that's what Kim Davis should do. I think she should take her case to the public. She's been pretty quiet lately. It seems to me that speaking out on it is an appropriate thing to do to change the environment of the culture of the nation.
Let's turn now to an issue you talked about in your opening remarks. That's the issue of immigration. And Colin Hanna has that question.
Governor.
My friend Colin.
America's foreign-born population is now over 13%
of the total population over 40 million and up 1 million just between 2013 and 14. This is a transformative mass migration that has occurred without any plan, without any strategy, without appropriate legislation, and without input from the American people. How would you, Governor, as president, secure the borders, not simply the Mexican border, but all of our borders in order to stem illegal immigration, and what sorts of limits ought to be put on legal immigration? Thank you.
Actually, some years ago, I actually worked with a company that was addressing the issue of what was called the U.S. Visit Program, which was an effort to actually track people as they came in and make them report. I don't think that it's been a success. I don't think that's been a success. And while we were looking at those issues, there was some discussion about the northern border between Canada and the United States. You know how far that is? That's an enormous amount of length. It's going to be so difficult to do anything about that. But the southern border is probably manageable. I don't think probably you can physically build a wall across the southern border, but you can build a system that begins to reduce this constant overflow of illegal people coming across the country through technology, through our drone looking, through border control people, and you can actually make a dedication to the issue to make sure that you are minimizing, if not eliminating, illegal crossings into this country. So I think it can be done, and as president, I would do that. Now, the other issue, of course, is overstays by visas. I believe the number is over almost 50%, over 40% are people who are overstaying their visas. And that is going to be a real challenge in a free society where you're not looking at everybody. I don't believe you're going to be able to box up everybody and send them back. But I do not agree that there ought to be a road to citizenship through an amnesty program. The position I've certainly taken is that people who are here illegal do not have a path to citizenship in this country under a Gilmore administration. We will not do that. So those are the approaches that I'm taking as I go forward. We're going to make sure that people who commit crimes are gotten out of here as quick as possible. We're going to make sure we secure the southern border. There are ways to oversee and at least watch the northern border. I'm not going to eliminate birthright citizenship in this country under the 14th. I'm not going to attack the 14th Amendment, and I think that Donald Trump is wrong with his interpretation of the law. But we should strictly enforce the rules and deport people. And, you know, we've inherited a problem, but anybody that comes into this country illegally, overstays now, should be deported. And as president, I'll make that clear from day one.
And legal immigration limits?
As far as legal immigration limits, now, let me say this. Legal immigration can be a strength for this nation. We have seen inflows of people into this country because they want to make a better life. We've seen it with the Irish. My family came over here in 1842 from Ireland. We've seen it with Chinese and Japanese people in the West Coast. We've seen influxes, and now we're seeing it from Latinos from South America desperately trying to do something. I thought that Donald Trump was wrong when he said a person comes into this country and has a baby. I'm not in favor of birthright people trying to abuse birthright citizenship. I think it's awful, and I think it could be administered through the visa process. But I would aspire for that young child, if they're going to stay here, to actually become educated and productive and actually go and grow. So in short, the direct answer to your question is I'm not against legal immigration. And I would like to see good quality people come in and under a process where we can vet people out and make sure they ought to, in fact, have a good chance of becoming real citizens that can be productive in this country. Let me tell you a quick story, Colin, and then I'll stop on this and go to the next question. Still got plenty of time, Tony. A couple of years ago, I was approached by someone who said, you know, I'm bringing a community college class into Washington, D.C. Would you be willing to come over and talk to him about the Republican Party and the conservative movement? So I did. And when I went into that conference room, there were about 15 young people from a community college in California, and they were almost all, in fact, they were all Latino, except one bright African-American girl in the class. And I told them about free enterprise and liberty and ideas and the Constitution and the ideas that we hold so dear. And at the end of it, this young woman, she was very Latino, and she probably was the child of an illegal immigrant. And she said to me, I understand everything you've said, but why do you hate us so much? I think we send that impression. Yet this young woman is going to be a productive citizen in this country. And I think that we ought to encourage that, because we are in the 21st century going to confront 1.3 billion Chinese, and we're going to confront 1.4 billion Indians. And the United States is the third largest population in the world, and we need good quality people. But we have a right to control who comes into this country and who doesn't. Open borders are not acceptable to the Gilmore administration, and people in this country illegally shall not have a path to citizenship.
Following up to Colin's question on legal immigration, do you feel like we're effectively assimilating immigrants into this country? And if not, what can we do?
It'll take a couple of generations, but we probably are. We all get very nervous when we're out here and we see people that are not speaking our English language, that are speaking the Spanish language. We get very frustrated and concerned. It isn't just people in the Latin community. We have people from all the world coming into this country, and they're all speaking different languages all the time. But the fact is that I stand for the English as the American language. I stand for the necessity of people understanding it and using it and making a part of the common culture. Culture does follow language, and we should not become a balkanized country with lots and lots of different enclaves. They do that actually in Europe, and they're paying that price now. We must assimilate people into this country. How are we doing? Well, not bad. America is such a powerful assimilating country, and always has been, that I believe that they will be coming in, and furthermore, and they will be assimilated. Furthermore, the personal experience that I have, I gave you the community college example, she's assimilating, that young lady. All of her colleagues are too. And as for their children, I had a daughter-in-law, as a matter of fact, who was a teacher in an elementary school, and she would come home and talk to me about how frustrating it was because the kids couldn't speak English. But they do, after four or five grades, speak English. And they do better. And they must do better, because you cannot survive in this country without, in any commercial activity or any kind of cultural activity, they speaking our native language of this country, and I think we should.
Thank you, Governor. Let's move on to another kind of foreign policy related question, and Cherie Short has that question.
Thank you, Governor Gilmore. And in an op-ed, Penny Nance, the CEO and president of Concerned Women for America, she wrote about, according to New York Times reporter Joseph Goldstein, there are reports that our military was ignoring sexual abuse in Afghanistan because it was expedient. As commander-in-chief, how would you address these allegations, and what actions would you take to protect these innocent children, young girls, and Christian women forced to be brides at the brutal hands of ISIS? Thank you.
You've asked a foreign policy question and a cultural question. First of all, I don't know what's happened to the United States commanders who permitted these young boys to become sex slaves over there, either on or around our military facilities, but they ought to be court-martialed and gotten out of the military right away. We need to stand. It isn't just to be punitive, it's to send the right message, which I think was the essence of your question. We Americans have to stand for what's right around the world. And you know, if some people in other cultures have values that aren't like ours, we should assert our values. We should not be talking about the radical Islamic values as a part of the future of civilization in the 21st century. ISIS conduct needs to be denounced by the American president as barbaric. Now, there's a lot of people that say that this president won't talk about radical Islamism. I sure will, because it's brutal, and it's savage, and it's barbaric, and it's Middle Ages. It's not in accord with the 21st century. And that's the role that America has to play. We have a role to establish the values of the 21st century as we have in the 20th. And we have a moral right to do that, to protect children, to stand for the rights of women, to address this issue of ISIS. Now, this Middle East situation is highly complicated because the president has allowed it to get out of hand. But I know this: ISIS cannot stand Don't kid yourself. The Russians aren't fighting ISIS. Oh, they'll push them back a little bit to protect Assad. They'll do that. But their main attack is on our allies. That's really what they're doing. And this is a time in which I believe that American leadership is vital. There are some people in our party that want to pull back, just like Barack Obama does, and withdraw America back into a shell, or at least set a standard that says that we're not going to be really engaged in the world unless we absolutely desperately have to. We've seen that in the 20th century. The result is a major war or the knocking back of our cultural values. That can't be permitted. Isolationism cannot be permitted. Neither can constant intervention in other countries either. I think that we've gone too far with some of our interventions. But there is a place for American leadership, both military and our values and our culture, that stands for what's right. And our involvement in foreign countries is vital in order to protect our values and, frankly, the safety of this country. There is a way to knock down this country. There is a way to do it. If you can keep us from trading, keep us from interacting, make us withdraw into ourselves, stop the ability to draw upon the advantages of other countries and give them our advantages and to create a comparative advantage in the world today. If you knock us back and make us withdraw, then we become weaker. If you intervene recklessly, the enemy knows with a guerrilla war that we can begin to expend our treasure unnecessarily. There must be an active American diplomacy that provides American leadership, both military and culturally. And that's why I've called for a Middle East NATO. A Middle East NATO with the Egyptians, the Jordanians, especially the Turks, who today we ought to have their attention right now with the Russian incursion into Syria. And to create something where we could actually assert American values and strengths in the world. And I think that this is not the time to put an amateur in the White House that doesn't know nothing about foreign policy. And again, I'm not trying to pick on Donald Trump. He's doing just fine, obviously. But the fact is that you just really can't seriously put somebody in the White House who says they get their military information from watching generals on television. Come on. Not really. This is too important a time, and there is a serious, serious threat to this country. And it is not the time to put amateurs in the White House like we've had for the last 8 years and like some might put into the next 8 years.
Yeah, you got to watch some of those generals. Yeah. I got one of them works with me. We're going to move now into the lightning round of questions here, Governor, in the final few moments that we have together. First, what do you see from your perspective is the single greatest threat facing our nation today?
The single greatest threat facing our nation today is the slow economy in this country that is destroying our optimism in the future and our real material wealth for the future. The single greatest threat today is that the Democratic Party is becoming a socialist party and they will apply policies that will destroy the economy and liberty of this country. That is the single greatest danger to this country today. And when I become the president, the first thing I'm going to do, besides some certain diplomatic approaches which have to be made in the first hour, besides that, I'm going to convene people and we're going to talk about a policy to get the economy of this country back on the track again so that we can have optimism and encouragement about the future and the growth of this country. That is the single greatest threat. The Socialist Party of this country is the single greatest threat.
Second question, that first day is going to be a long one because the president has put into place a number of executive orders. Will you rescind those executive orders? And then how would you use the authority of executive power?
Well, first of all, the president, with his immigration executive order, it was in violation of the Constitution. You cannot use an executive order to simply repeal the laws of the United States. So he's wrong about that. Executive orders are intended to carry out the laws, not to make the laws, and to make things work in an appropriate and proper way in terms of the administration and the execution of the laws. So we'll look at all the executive orders of the Obama administration. I'll have a staff there to look at each one, and each one that carries out liberal policies inappropriately and is in violation of the Constitution and stretches too far will be rescinded. I'll tell you that now. Why am I going to? Sure, I can stand up here and tell you, yeah, we'll get rid of all of them. Well, no, I've been around. I've been a chief executive. I'm going to look at the doggone executive orders, okay? And then we'll determine. But I will tell you my standard. And my standard is, if the president is overreached, if he's in violation of the Constitution, or he's carrying out liberal policies with them, they will be rescinded.
So we'll have men and women's bathrooms back in the White House?
Yes, we will.
Okay, very good.
I assume they're there now. I mean,
no, they've changed, and they're all transgender bathrooms in the White House now.
Oh, my. Well, we'll get that correct.
Let's talk about the issue of conservatives that you seek counsel from and those that are close to you that you would be getting advice from.
Well, look, I kind of knew that question was coming. I was trying to make a list. It's impossible to make a list. Many of the people in this room would be consulted by me as President of the United States. So would you. So would a man like Richard Viguerie. I asked Richard to come up here and stand up and speak out for me because he's a long-standing old friend. And he has made the point to me over and over again, you know what kind of president you got with who's around them. So I'm going to have conservatives around me because that's, frankly, the only people I actually know. So I guess that we'll make sure that we have the right type of conservatives around that are well-known in the movement. Morton Blackwell's been my friend for over 50 years, I believe, as a matter of fact. It's pretty scary, isn't it? But Morton is a wise man and has been a good conservative leader. I would look to him, but I would look to you. I would look to Richard and a large number of others. But the point is that we have to find out what conservatives are leading on the appropriate issues and then go and get them in the White House on a constant basis.
I'm going to turn just a little personal here for a moment, and we talk about the role of faith. What role does your faith play in the decisions that you make, and how would that affect you if you were to be in the White House?
You know, it's funny. I've been asked that question in the past, and I've always flubbed it. I haven't done very well with that question, and I've soft pondered Tony a little bit. I've thought about it. I've said I'm going to get asked that question again one of these days. I've been a United Methodist all my life. My mother was a church secretary. She retired as secretary to the bishop of the United Methodist Church. But that's no talisman. For me, my faith in Jesus Christ is always there. I don't feel like I've got to stand up with a bullhorn. There's that tradition, and that's fine for people that have that. It isn't mine. I believe that it's like a constant companion. It's like a trust in the Savior that's with me at all times. It's not something that's extraordinary that all of a sudden is there and I have to say, oh, look at that. It's with me all the time. My faith in Jesus and my faith in Christ and the way that I have been built into this through the raising of my family and especially that of my mother. Dad wasn't quite as religious as Mom was, but she was quite devout and raised me in that manner. But I thought about it a lot. It's just always there. It's always with you. And it's always, I think, built into your values, your ethics, and your faith in grace and in salvation.
Thank you, Governor. What is unique about your leadership that would set you apart from the other candidates in this Republican primary?
Well, steadfastness, for one thing. I don't come to CNP and talk to you and try to persuade you I'm a conservative. You know, my conservatism is beyond question. It's been there my whole life. I'm not sure all your candidates are like that. Some are kind of new to this. But I think maybe the uniqueness is this. I've been a governor. I know what it is to govern a state. I know how to deal with the budgets. I know how to deal with the rhinos. I know how to deal with the opposition party. I know what it is to actually have to face things like a 9/11, a crisis. I know what it is to be able to draw upon that kind of experience and to frankly bring a record to you that you can look at and determine, why would I come to you now in any other way than the way I've always been? And secondly, I have a foreign policy experience that the other candidates quite simply just don't have. They just don't have it. I think the best, maybe, I mean, is a couple of members of, one member maybe of the Senate who doesn't really have the same kind of foreign policy I do, and maybe another one who served on a congressional committee. But nobody else has studied it as a profession with a degree. Nobody else has been a veteran. Okay, Lindsey Graham's a veteran. He was a military lawyer. But I actually was on station in Europe, and so I saw the Russians. Not from Alaska either. I saw them actually, okay? And I understand what it is to travel across the world on diplomatic and trade issues as governor. I've been to Afghanistan, Israel, Croatia. I've been to Pakistan. I understand what the world is around me. I've been in charge during 9/11. And most importantly, I chaired the National Commission on Homeland Security for 5 years in this country. The Gilmore Commission reports remain the Bible of anti-terrorism for the United States. I have a knowledge of these issues and a commitment on these issues the other candidates don't have. And I believe that with conservative values, deep experience, and foreign policy experience, that I bring to you someone that the American people will have faith in. So the question of all that is, Tony, okay, so what? But can you win? And the answer is, maybe not. Maybe the American people have arrived at a point where they just simply want the flash and the bang. And if they do, they do. If they do, they do. But I know this, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not going to retire and play golf and watch my country go down the tubes. I'm not going to do it.
Final question, and I think I know the answer because you've paid your dues in advance. But if you were elected as president, would you return to continue this conversation with your friends here at the CMP?
Always have, always will. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Governor.
Be with you.
Thank you so much. Folks, just a couple of announcements. Let's thank the governor again for joining us, Governor Jim Gilmore. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
He's going to be next door for photographs.